KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The Tel Aviv sky lit up tonight as Israel shot down incoming missiles from Iran.
This after Israel attacked Iranian nuclear sites and killed Iran's army chief and the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps.
We'll hear from our correspondent in a Tel Aviv bomb shelter this Friday, June 13th on All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, we'll meet the Israeli entrepreneur behind both a Michelin-starred restaurant in Manhattan
and a hugely controversial food program in Gaza.
Only because he has his heart on the right place. If someone brings food to Gaza, it's better than nothing, no? I don't know.
Also, climate change is starting to influence how we tear buildings down.
Typically what happens is a bulldozer will come in, smash it all, it'll all get trashed. But deconstruction, we try to salvage and recycle as much as possible.
And big baseball news, Bruce the Bat Dog has been called to the majors.
Woof woof, versus news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog group says the level of radioactivity did not change at the first target of Israeli strikes in Iran, but the official is expressing alarm, and Israeli forces target two more nuclear sites today, and Iran responds by firing hundreds of missiles at Israel. More from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Rafael Grossi, who heads the International Atomic Energy Agency, says he's been in constant contact with Iranian nuclear authorities after the first wave of strikes hit the Natanz facility.
The above ground part of the pilot fuel enrichment plant, where Iran was producing uranium and reached up to 60% uranium-235, has been destroyed.
And he says underground centrifuges may have been damaged by power cuts. Grossi tells the UN Security Council that there's no radiological impact there. He's still looking into strikes on Fordo and Isfahan and offered to travel to Iran soon. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News.
Iran, through its UN ambassador, says at least 78 people died in the Israeli strike. Hundreds were injured. Iran retaliated with missile strikes against Israel, with dozens reportedly injured there. One segment of the economy that's been severely affected by the Trump administration's immigration crackdown has been agriculture. Federal agents today rounding up dozens of California farm workers in raids at packing houses and fields. Many of the arrests took place on farms northwest of Los Angeles. Some laborers, even those with legal status, have stopped showing up for work since the raids began, fearing deportation. California grows much of the country's fresh produce, and farmers have complained the raids make it harder for them to do business. A man who was wrongly deported from Maryland to El Salvador is back in the U.S. and now fighting criminal charges. Mariana Bacallao from member station WPLN reports Kilmar Abrego-Garcia pleaded not guilty to human smuggling charges in Nashville today.
Abrego-Garcia arrived in the U.S. last week after spending 3 months in an El Salvadoran prison. In that time, his case has galvanized critics of the Trump administration's immigration policy, and Homeland Security has begun investigating a 2022 traffic stop in which Tennessee state troopers found that Abrego-Garcia was driving 9 other men to Maryland. Prosecutors say he was paid thousands of dollars to move people without legal status through the country. A federal judge did not rule from the bench on whether Abrego-Garcia has a right to bail. But if he is released, he'll be transferred to ICE custody, where officials say he will be held until his trial or deportation. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacallao in Nashville.
A major downdraft on Wall Street today amid rising tensions in the Mideast. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 769 points. The Nasdaq down 255. This is NPR. President Trump has said he wants the U.S. to build more commercial ships to compete with China. One way Trump plans to do that is by making it more expensive for China to build ships through higher port fees. Stephen Bashaha with the Gulf States Newsroom says there are questions about Trump's strategy.
Commercial shipbuilding is a bipartisan concern because they're used during wartime for supply runs. Bradley Byrne is the head of the Mobile Chamber of Commerce. He says China's shipbuilding dominance is a national security concern.
So what if we're in a war with China? We can't use their ships. So this is a national security problem as much as it is a problem for our economy.
All Chinese-built and operated ships will pay U.S. port fees starting in October. But tariffs could outweigh any American shipbuilding incentives. They've caused a drop in traffic at U.S. ports, reducing demand for new ships, Chinese or American. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Mobile, Alabama.
Just a day after the death of his Beach Boys bandmate Brian Wilson, group member Mike Love has been inducted into the 2025 Songwriters Hall of Fame. The gala in New York last night included other inductees as well, including George Clinton, the Doobie Brothers, and Ashley Gordon. Love, meanwhile, says he looks back fondly on Brian Wilson, his cousin and Beach Boys collaborator. Brian Wilson's death was announced Wednesday. He was 82 years old. Crude oil futures prices jumped today on the escalating conflict between Israel and Iran in the Middle East, oil making some of its biggest midday moves in years to end the session up more than 7.5% at $72.98 a barrel. I'm Jack Speer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. If you took your eye off the Middle East these last 24 hours or so, you have missed a lot. To catch you up quickly, Iran has launched at least 100 missiles at Israel. This after Israel launched a massive attack on Iran, striking nuclear sites, killing the country's top military commanders, also nuclear scientists, and according to Iran, dozens of Iranian civilians. Well, tonight, loud explosions sent people in Israel running for their shelters. Among them, NPR's own Hadil Al-Shalchi, who joins us now from a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv. Hey there.
Hello.
Hi. And we also have NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie, not in a bomb shelter in Washington. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Hey. Okay. So, Hadil, you start. You are in Tel Aviv. You're in a bunker. First question, are you okay? What are you hearing? What does it actually sound like there tonight?
Yeah, thank you. I'm doing okay. So we started actually getting these alerts from the Israeli military to stay near a shelter, you know, on our phones. Then the sirens came, and then we started hearing these massive explosions across the city. So we made a run for the shelter, which is, like you said, I'm speaking to you from there now. The Israeli military said that the booms we're hearing were interceptions by Israel's powerful air defense system, also known as the Iron Dome. But the military also confirmed that some areas in central Tel Aviv were struck, including a high-rise building that caught fire. And also it said that people have been injured from shrapnel. As I speak, I'm hearing more sirens, more booms outside, and friends have actually sent me videos showing red fireballs lighting up the sky. This is, of course, all happening as Israel is pushing ahead with its own attack. The military said it struck the central city of Isfahan, which has a nuclear fuel plant, and explosions were also heard from around a nuclear facility called Fordo, which is underground. Earlier in the day, Iran said that Israel had struck its main nuclear facility called Natanz, and the attacks have delivered some major blows. Three top security officials, including the Iranian army's chief of staff, were killed, and many nuclear scientists, according to the Iranian military.
Well, and I will just note, Greg Myrie, I have stood beside you in Tel Aviv when the Iron Dome went up and you could hear it shooting down missiles. Unusual for the strikes to have made contact and to see actually injuries tonight in the country. Let me turn you to the U.S. role. What, if anything, is the U.S. role in events unfolding right now?
Well, we don't know everything, but Secretary of State Marco Rubio put out a clear statement shortly after the Israeli attacks began to say the U.S. was not involved and that Iran should not go after U.S. targets. Now, the U.S. did get a heads up from Israel, and we kind of saw this in real time the past couple days as the U.S. took precautions with personnel in the region, diplomats and troops, but it's not clear that the U.S. gave Israel a green light. Trump has consistently opposed Israeli military action against Iran, saying he wanted a negotiated deal to place strict limits on Iran's nuclear program. Trump was calling for a deal as recently as yesterday, but today he was asked by Axios whether the Israeli strike undermined the talks, and Trump said, quote, "I don't think so. Maybe the opposite. Maybe now they will negotiate seriously. However, we should note Iran says it won't take part in negotiations that were planned for Sunday."
Hadil, back to you in Tel Aviv, and I want to ask about the specifics of this Israeli attack on Iran, because there are some similarities, is that right, some parallels between an earlier attack when Israel killed the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, in a bombing raid. That was Beirut last fall.
That's right. So there are some parallels, like you said, between the Israeli attacks on Lebanon that led to Nasrallah's killing and the ones we're seeing today in Iran. Last fall, Israel carried out an attack using pagers, which were used by Hezbollah members that blew up because Israel had concealed explosives in them. And today, Israeli security officials said that Israel's spy agency, known as the Mossad, smuggled weapons into Iran ahead of the attack. They said that a base for launching explosive drones was established inside Iran and that the drones were activated to target missile launchers at another base near Tehran. Now, see, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been dreaming of taking out Iran's nuclear facilities for almost 30 years. And in fact, in a video speech today, he referred to a book he wrote in 1982, where he said that the current Iranian regime was a threat to Israel.
And Hadil, one more to you in terms of the Iranian response. They had said expect vengeance. They seem to be following through. What are you watching for?
Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly, Iran is certainly pushing back right now. Iran attacked Israel twice last year, but they didn't do very much damage. But this time, Israel is saying this operation could last many days, even weeks. The chances that this really slips out of control is growing by the minute. Israel had warned that Iran would use its ballistic missiles again. Israel's also closed all of its embassies worldwide and warned its nationals overseas to keep a low profile. So it obviously fears attacks on them, too.
Greg Myrie, last question to you. This is obviously a very aggressive Israeli operation that we are seeing continuing to unfold against Iran's nuclear program. What is the goal? Is it just let's slow down or destroy Iran's nuclear program? Or is it something bigger, an attempt perhaps to provoke regime change?
Well, I think certainly the primary goal is to inflict as much damage as Israel can on Iran's nuclear program. When I was based there in the early 2000s, Israel was often talking about this goal. In addition, Israel would welcome any weakening of Iran's Islamic leadership and would be thrilled if it was ousted, but that's not something Israel could expect to bring about with airstrikes alone. In the short term, Iranians are quite likely to rally around the flag in response to these Israeli attacks. Also, Iran's government has proved extremely resilient for 46 years and remains in firm control. These sustained Israeli attacks could unleash all sorts of unintended consequences, including putting more pressure on the Iranian government. But at this stage, there's no reason to think it will generate an internal uprising that would threaten the government.
NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie here in Washington. We've also been speaking with NPR's Hadil Alshalchi in a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv. Stay safe. Thank you, you too.
You're welcome.
Sure thing, Mary Louise.
A day after India's most serious aviation disaster in decades, authorities say they have found the plane's black box. The discovery gives authorities hope that they can uncover the cause of the incident that killed more than 200 people. NPR's Dia Hadid has more from Mumbai.
The sole survivor was the passenger in seat 11A. As bystanders filmed him, he walked out of the smoking wreckage of a London-bound Air India flight that had 242 people on board when it smashed into a medical college and burst into flames. It happened on Thursday, just moments after takeoff from the city of Ahmedabad. The survivor, 40-year-old British national Vishwaskumar Ramesh, appeared bloodied and dazed. Later in the hospital, Ramesh told the Indian daily The Hindu that he managed to get out through the emergency exit before the plane blew up.
I just walked out, didn't I?
I just walked out. If it sounded improbable to listeners, it apparently also sounded improbable to Ramesh.
I can't explain. It's medical, everything.
His brother, who was a few seats away, was killed. Other casualties included medical students in the building and bystanders. But the final death toll isn't clear. Authorities say they have to identify the bodies using DNA from relatives. The crash comes amid India's ambitions to be a global aviation hub and as the government builds airports across regional centres at breakneck speed. But one safety expert, Mohan Raghunathan, told NPR that many of India's airports did not comply with safety standards that are meant to ensure there's no large obstacles near airports.
If this doesn't wake them up, nothing will.
He noted that in Thursday's deadly crash, the plane struck a six-story building just seconds after takeoff.
Well, it's such a tall building, very close to the takeoff path, just 300 meters from the compound wall. Maybe a serious violation of the obstacle clearance.
NPR reached out to India's Civil Aviation Authority, the Federal Aviation Minister, Air India, and its corporate owners, the Tata Group, but did not receive a response to those allegations. The plane involved in the crash was a Boeing 787 Dreamliner. It's a workhorse of long-haul flights, and this was the first deadly accident in its history, according to experts cited by the Associated Press. Aviation expert Amit Singh told NPR that Air India's safety standards has been lacking. He described a culture of fear that stopped aviation staff from reporting problems to managers, and managers hiding problems from the aviation watchdog. On Friday, the aviation watchdog directed Air India to carry out extra checks on its 787s as, quote, a preventative measure following the aircraft crash. Boeing says it will support the investigation led by Indian authorities. Dee Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
Most baseball legends get their start in the minor leagues. You get called into the coach's office with the news you've made it through the farm system, every player's dream.
And that time is here for one Washington Nationals minor league star.
Bruce, get your bat. Oh.
Bruce the Bat Dog got the news this week. He is getting called up to the majors.
The Rochester Red Wings, the Nationals' AA team in upstate New York, shared the call-up announcement on Instagram.
Hey, come on in, big dog. I got some news for you. I think you're going to like it. You know, last year you got called up to AAA, and the one thing that the front office noticed, man, you're working your tail off every single day. But I'm excited to invite you to Nats Park for your call-up to the major leagues on June the 14th. Congratulations.
Bruce is the gold standard. Make that the golden retriever standard when it comes to dogs in the dugout. He got his promotion to the majors after posting a perfect retrieving average in three games.
Bruce makes his major league debut Saturday in a homestand against the Miami Marlins.
Go, Bruce. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. As NPR's Climate Solutions Week continues, there is a growing movement to approach old buildings not as teardowns, but as resources to mine for reusable materials. KUNC's Ray Solomon reports.
The year was 1954. Construction crews were busy developing Boulder, Colorado, as a working-class community. They built small, single-family homes like this one, a snug three-bed, two-bath with metal siding near the top of a green, hilly street. But some 70 years later, that modest home no longer fits the bill for today's Boulderites who want more spacious, modern dwellings. It needs to go. So now a very different type of crew is busy in the neighborhood.
Our team is systematically unbuilding the structure.
That's contractor Anna Perks. The roof of this house is already long gone, siding too. Workers now wield hammers and crowbars, prying pieces of wood sheathing off the studs and carefully sorting materials. Others claw nails out of 2x6s in the backyard.
We've got a pretty good pile of lumber that's all ceiling joists and floor joists, and there's a lot of good reusable lumber in there.
Perk's job here illustrates a big shift in how we think about clearing away old buildings to make way for the new. Not demolition, but the meticulous, deliberate process of deconstruction.
Typically what happens is a bulldozer will come in, smash it all, it'll all get trashed. But deconstruction, we try to salvage and recycle as much as possible.
The idea is to limit the climate impact of our built environment, which accounts for nearly 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Michelle Lambert with the nonprofit Carbon Leadership Forum says about half of that comes from the embodied carbon of construction materials.
It's all of the greenhouse gas emissions in the process of creating, installing, using, and disposing of building materials.
The big promise of deconstruction, she says, is in creating a circular economy for building materials, harvesting lumber, say, from an old house rather than a forest.
Making use of the materials that we have already manufactured is one of the most impactful ways that we can reduce embodied carbon, eliminating all of those emissions that would have been required to create new materials.
A handful of local governments, from California to Florida and counting, now require that some amount of demolition waste be salvaged for reuse or recycling. Here in Boulder, more than 140 million pounds of materials have been kept out of landfills since such an ordinance was adopted in 2020. But that doesn't mean it's easy. You need infrastructure for processing and distributing all those salvaged materials, not to mention people who want to buy them. A lot of places don't have those markets. And according to developer Chris Fellows, deconstruction can be much pricier than traditional demolition.
I think percentage-wise, probably 35 to 40% more expensive.
That's because of the time and labor involved. Fellows hired Perks to deconstruct a few crumbling farm buildings at a site he's now developing as a mixed-use residential neighborhood in Aurora. He says the process added at least a year to his project schedule. Even so, he's glad they went for it.
We wanted to be good stewards of the land in terms of the climate and the environment. So to the extent that we could reuse and recycle any materials, we wanted to do that.
He expects an eventual return on the investment when eco-conscious homebuyers learn about his process. And as the deconstruction movement matures, Perk says builders can start planning for disassembly on the front end.
When you're designing, can you think about what's this going to be like to take it down? And when it gets taken down, can it be reused?
So the future of climate-conscious construction could be knowing exactly how you'd take a building apart before you even put it together. For NPR News, I'm Ray Solomon in Boulder, Colorado.
And on Weekend Edition tomorrow morning, 5 easy ways to reduce your electricity use. And you can find all of this week's climate solutions at npr.org/climateweek.
Speaking of electricity use, refrigerators, washing machines, and other appliances are the latest items to face new tariffs. The Trump administration is expanding its steel and aluminum tariffs. NPR's Alina Selyukh is here to explain how exactly. Hi, Alina.
Hello, hello.
All right, so explain. What's the news here?
Okay, so the Commerce Department is expanding the current tariffs on steel and aluminum to apply not just to raw materials, but parts inside finished goods. Okay, so right now there's a tariff on imported steel and aluminum raw, and it actually just doubled last week to 50%. Mm-hmm. And starting June 23rd, this tariff will start applying to steel and aluminum content inside some imported appliances. So if you're shipping a dishwasher into the U.S., you'll have to pay the general tariff to import the machine plus that 50% tariff on the metal content of that dishwasher.
And how many appliances are we talking? We said dishwashers. What else?
Yeah, so also washing machines, dryers, refrigerators with freezers, separate freezers, stoves, ovens, garbage disposal.
Huh. And what's the thinking here? Why?
Well, in a way, it's an effort to undo the imbalance between American manufacturers and foreign ones that was actually created by the original steel and aluminum tariffs. Right now, if you want to make a washing machine in the U.S., you have to pay that 50% tariff to bring in foreign steel. Well, your foreign competitor, meanwhile, can buy steel cheaper overseas, can make the washer overseas, and then ship it complete into the U.S., facing a tariff of possibly just 10%. Domestic manufacturers have long argued that that's unfair, that imported appliances in this case should face the same tariff on whatever raw material was used inside of it, and that's what they're getting here. Two companies that will face this in particular are Samsung and LG. They do have some factories in the U.S., but they also ship a ton from South Korea and Mexico.
Alina, just to bring this down to the level of my kitchen.
Okay.
Your kitchen and
sure,
all of
yes.
our kitchens.
Let's do it.
If my dishwasher conks out and I have to buy a new one next month, does this boil down to it's going to cost me more?
Probably. Maybe. For example, when President Trump in his first term imposed tariffs on foreign washers, that did boost domestic manufacturing, but prices for shoppers did also go up. And actually not just the washers, but also dryers, which did not face a tariff. But, you know, companies spread the costs on both appliances because they're often bought together.
Sure.
Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent faced the price question this week at a Senate hearing, and he pointed out that so far, tariffs have not caused a surge in inflation.
There has been nothing passed on. There has been no tariff recession. So no inflation, no recession due to tariffs.
And he called out Home Depot, for example, as one company saying that it is not planning broad price increases to offset tariffs.
That seems notable. Is it true?
So what Home Depot, this is what Home Depot said in May, but I do want to clarify that when I followed up with Home Depot, the company did sort of specify that it might have to raise some prices, or it might have to change up the selection on the shelves to avoid losing money on tariffs. And of course, there is also a concern about the cumulative impact of tariffs. Bessent is right. Inflation overall is holding steady. But home appliances were one of the main categories that did go up in price in May. Major appliances specifically went up by more than 4%.
NPR's Alina Selyukh. Happy dishwashing.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
I was here the night when it happened.
A decade ago, a white supremacist killed 9 black worshipers at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston.
It really mattered that it was this place that the killer targeted.
The church, its history of resisting racism, and Kevin Sachs' new book, Mother Emmanuel, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Broadchurch creator Chris Chibnall moves from your TV screen to the page with a debut crime novel.
Everybody's locked in together, looking suspiciously across the bar or the village street at each other, and that just becomes very delicious in terms of that pressure cooker atmosphere.
Now news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Hurst. Iran's ambassador to the UN says at least 78 people are dead, hundreds injured in Israeli attacks on Tehran's nuclear sites and military leaders. Israel launched the attacks last night over Tehran's nuclear ambitions. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
In the past 24 hours, we've taken out top military commanders, senior nuclear scientists, the Islamic regime's most significant enrichment facility, and a large portion of its ballistic missile arsenal. More is on the way. The regime doesn't know what hit them. They don't know what will hit them.
Iran retaliated today with ballistic missile strikes on seven sites in Israel, injuring at least 34, according to Israeli health officials. EU and NATO leaders are calling for de-escalation on worries the violence will spread. President Trump's trade war continues to be a drag on cargo traffic at the port of Los Angeles. And Pierre Scott Horsley reports that means less work for dock workers, truck drivers, and warehouse workers.
Last month was the slowest in more than 2 years at the port of Los Angeles, a key point of entry for imports from China. Much of that Asian shipping traffic came to a standstill when President Trump imposed his triple-digit tariffs. The port's executive director, Gene Soroka, says cargo volumes have since rebounded to more normal levels after tariffs on Chinese goods were cut, at least temporarily, to 30%.
And we're happy with that because that means more dock workers and truckers will be out on the job hauling this cargo. But I don't see the surge that some observers had called for.
Soroka says that could mean less selection and higher prices during the usually busy back-to-school and Halloween shopping seasons. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Crude oil prices soared by the close, up 7.5%, ending the day at $73.18 a barrel. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington. A new report on child labor globally shows there's been progress in reducing the number of children who had to work in 2024, but more needs to be done to eliminate the problem. NPR's Fatma Tanis has more.
When children are working, it means they're not able to go to school or play as other children do. According to the report by UNICEF and the International Labor Organization, 138 million children were involved in child labor last year. 54 million of them were in hazardous work. That means mines or working at dangerous heights and being exposed to chemicals. Data shows there has been progress, a total reduction of 20 million children since 2020. Much of that has been in Asia, where social protections and education mandates have helped kids stay in school. In sub-Saharan Africa, however, progress has been slow. Emerging conflicts have contributed to extreme poverty, pushing families to keep relying on their children's labor for survival. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
In India, investigators have recovered the digital flight data and cockpit voice recorders of the Air India flight that crashed yesterday, killing all 241 people on board and more on the ground. One man survived. The London-bound Boeing 787 Dreamliner plane hit a medical college when it crashed into a residential area minutes after takeoff. The cause is under investigation. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. An Israeli entrepreneur is behind two ventures. One is an international sensation, a restaurant group with a Michelin star. The other is an international controversy, a food program in Gaza, mired in deadly violence. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
We are inside the beating heart of Israel's culinary scene. This is Miznon. It's a street food restaurant, very Mediterranean. This guy is smashing a mashed potato with creme fraiche. When you look at the menu here, it says this restaurant is powered by Eyal Shani, the celebrity chef, and his business partner, Shachar Segal.
He took the sparks and made it fire, big fire.
Israeli food writer Hila Alpert says Shachar Segal, a TV ad director, helped the celebrity chef create a global culinary phenomenon. One of his restaurants in Manhattan has a Michelin star.
He's very good at recognizing things, take it and make something out of it.
When Hamas attacked Israel in 2023 and Israel began its offensive in Gaza, Segal lent his branding expertise to the army, he told an Israeli podcast last year. I found myself in the army dealing with influence operations, narrative building, he says, fighting the narrative war against Hamas. A few weeks ago, he emerged as spokesman of a new food venture backed by the U.S. and conceived in Israel. It's called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. The idea is to provide civilians with food under Israeli military supervision without Hamas involvement. The result has been deadly. You're about to hear the sound of gunfire. This video shows masses of Palestinians crouching amid rubble and fleeing in an open field. A young man filming says, "Here's what's happening to us, just for flour." There's extreme hunger in Gaza, with Israel severely limiting food. And Gaza health officials say more than 220 people have been killed and 1,800 wounded while seeking food in recent weeks. The Israeli military says it's fired warning shots at people approaching troops near the food sites. GHF says it has no connection to this violence and says Hamas has killed and threatened Palestinians working for GHF. The United Nations and other aid groups have refused to work with GHF, saying it doesn't follow humanitarian principles. Palestinian-American Hani El-Madhoun of the Gaza Soup Kitchen opposes GHF.
We understand this is such a heartless enterprise. It is not the way to do humanitarian aid. And, you know, this is the situation where Palestinians end up being dead every time there is a food distribution.
A person familiar with GHF's activities says the Israeli government asked Shachar Segal, the Israeli restaurant owner, to join the group to project the image that the initiative has nutritional value for Gazans. The person requested we not name them because they're not authorized to speak with the media. Segal denies that. He told NPR there's no connection between his restaurant background and his involvement with GHF. In response to the violence near the food sites and criticism around the group, he wrote, "I believe this is the only correct and possible way to give food to Gazans without bankrolling Hamas's terror machine." His partner, Chef Eyal Shani, did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Alpert, the Israeli food writer, was surprised to hear Segal is representing the group.
I think that if Shachar does it, it's only because he has his heart on the right place. If someone brings food to Gaza, it's better than nothing, no? I don't know.
Video filmed by Palestinians show thousands crowding food sites operated by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
No, this way, this way, this way. No.
They run in droves to grab flour, pasta, cooking oil, whatever they can. GHF and the Israeli government have released different footage of smiling Palestinians with their food boxes in this Israeli government ad.
This is what real aid looks like. Smiles don't lie. Hamas does.
Segal sends daily updates about the Gaza Food Project from his base in New York, where his restaurant group is expanding to a new luxury condo development in Brooklyn. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
At the heart of legal challenges to President Trump's tariffs is a question about what authority the president has over tariffs at all. Willa Rubin from the Planet Money podcast has more.
The power to impose tariffs actually belongs to Congress. But over the years, Congress has delegated more of that power to the president, recognizing that they can be slow and the president needs to act quickly if there's a crisis. So, Georgetown trade law professor Kathleen Clausen says there are a few statutes where Congress outlines when and how the president can impose tariffs.
Most of these statutes go by their three digits. So if you want to sound cool in trade world, you have to start talking in three digits, right? Section 301, Section 232, Section 201, 122, 338, the list goes on.
Each of those three-digit statutes has clear rules. There need to be things like investigations, public hearings, reports, and if there's enough evidence, only then can the president impose tariffs. Now, President Trump campaigned on broad tariffs. So when he won, Kathleen and her trade law friends were wondering which statute he would use.
Is it going to be 301? Is it going to be 232? Is it going to be 122? Right? Very low on that list was IEEPA.
IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Within weeks of taking office, President Trump invoked IEEPA to impose sweeping new tariffs on many countries, which was unprecedented. IEEPA had never been used for tariffs before.
I think if we took a poll of anybody who's ever heard of IEEPA before, they would say this is a sanctions tool.
IEEPA is a law from the 70s. It was first used by President Jimmy Carter in 1979 during the Iran hostage crisis. Since then, presidents have used IEEPA for dozens of international emergencies to do things like freeze assets, embargo goods, or prohibit certain foreign transactions.
I mean, does IEEPA let Trump do this?
That is the magic question of the moment, and I can see the arguments on both sides.
One argument Trump's lawyers make is that the text of IEEPA is broad. It gives the president the power to, quote, regulate or prohibit all kinds of transactions. So just looking at IEEPA's language.
When you hear the words regulate importation, does that mean that I can charge you $5 to bring in your widget into the United States? Regulate importation. I bet I'd find a good contingent of people who, knowing nothing more than that, could get behind that interpretation of the language. Regulate importation means I can charge you to bring it in.
On the other hand, the people arguing against Trump's tariffs say this is overreach, that the president is taking two words in IEEPA, regulate importation, to kind of give himself a blank check to make whatever tariffs he wants.
How would you rule?
I don't think I would answer this well. I think this is a very tough case.
So far, the people challenging Trump's tariffs have been winning in lower courts, though the tariffs are still in effect while the White House appeals these cases. But even if higher courts, like the Supreme Court, eventually say Trump's tariffs using IEEPA are unlawful, that wouldn't mean the end of tariffs. It would just mean the Trump administration would have to go back to using the three-digit system. You know, making tariffs the old-fashioned way. Willa Rubin, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Tucked inside the House Republicans' budget bill is a really bold idea to punish colleges whose students leave with mountains of debt that they cannot pay off. Or, as Secretary of Education Linda McMahon has said, to force colleges to have, quote, a little skin in the game. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner explains what the plan looks like.
This bold idea around college risk sharing would work like this.
So like a particular student might have a $200 loan payment.
Jordan Matsudaira was a top education department official in the Biden administration.
If the student is delinquent and misses that payment, the institution becomes responsible for some fraction of that $200 that the student failed to pay.
The Biden and Obama administrations worked on their own version of, let's call it, college accountability. But they largely focused on for-profit colleges. Preston Cooper, with the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute, says House Republicans are trying to go bigger.
They are actually trying to target bad outcomes regardless of the sector.
Meaning any institution of higher education could get hit with one of these penalties. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that if enacted, the full risk-sharing proposal would save the government more than $6 billion over the next decade. There are a few wrinkles, though. For one, there are already signs that Republicans in the Senate may not be on board. Also, when it comes to the House plan, Dominique Baker at the University of Delaware says the math behind these school penalties has a hole in it.
The amount that would get charged for this would not include loan balances that were in default, which is very odd.
That's right. A plan to punish schools for burying students in debt would exclude loans once they go into default. Multiple experts told me this was likely done out of fear that including defaults would make the penalties too painful for some schools. As it is, AEI's Preston Cooper estimates that the schools on the hook for the biggest penalties would mostly fall into two categories: for-profit colleges like Strayer University and the University of Phoenix, and some big private nonprofit schools.
The University of Southern California really is the classic example.
Cooper says USC's undergrads seem to leave with pretty manageable debts. But in the 2019-2020 school year, he says, USC's graduate programs were responsible for more than $500 million in debt. In total, Cooper says, USC was responsible for
almost 1% of the student loans issued in the United States every year.
House Republicans' plan isn't all stick. There's also a carrot. These penalties that schools pay would be recycled into bonuses to reward schools that give low-income students the biggest bang for their buck. Instead of debt machines, think of them as social mobility engines. And of the 10 schools in line to get the largest bonuses, Cooper estimates 9 would be public universities, 3 in Florida, and 6 in California. Corey Turner, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Sometimes crime thrillers are a slow burn. Other times there is a dead body on page two. In the novel Death at the White Hart, that dead body has been found upright, tied to a chair in the middle of the road with deer antlers affixed to its head. The chilling discovery sends the village of Fleetcombe into a tailspin. Well, author Chris Chibnall is no stranger to a murder mystery set in the UK. He created the British TV crime drama Broadchurch, and he is here with us now to talk about his debut novel, Death at the White Hart. Chris Chibnall, welcome.
Thank you very much. What a great introduction. I'm very delighted to be here with you.
Well, introduce us to this body. Who is dead? What questions does this unleash in the tiny town of Fleetcombe?
The dead body is the landlord of the local pub in Fleetcombe, the White Hart of the title. Mm. And the landlord is called Jim Tiernan, and he's really just had a rambunctious night in his pub where many things have gone on. And you could surmise that a lot of the people in the pub that night in the village of Fleetcombe have reasons for wanting him dead.
Yes. There's a whole cast of characters, all of whom are somehow connected to Jim and all of whom are acting fishy as your plot gets underway.
That's right. Yeah. And I think part of this is I really wanted to write a murder mystery where it had all of those sort of golden age, great page turning Agatha Christie style setting, but with characters who live lives as we would all recognize them now.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't want to write a book like that? Congrats to you on doing it. I'm right there with you. I will say, I mean, it's the town, it's small. There are two pubs, and we're going to get to that in a second, the White Hart being one. It makes it, on the one hand, for a whodunit. You could introduce us to pretty much everyone in town. I felt like I would walk down every street and be saying hi to people as we went. On the other hand, it makes it tricky maybe to figure out who done it, because everybody knows everybody, everybody's looking out for everybody, everybody's friends.
Yeah, everybody knows everybody else's business, where they come from, their histories, and so everybody's locked in together, looking suspiciously across the bar or the village street at each other, and that just becomes very delicious in terms of that pressure cooker atmosphere.
One of my favorite characters is the new detective sergeant of Fleetcombe. This is Nicola Bridge. She has just moved back here. This is her hometown. She's back. She's not quite sure how she feels about that. And suddenly she finds herself leading a murder investigation. What is her strategy? How is she looking for a suspect? How is she ruling people out?
Well, I think she is having to deal with a number of things. One of the things she's returned to Fleetcombe and the area for is to have a bit more of a quiet life. But what she's returned to is a police force that is not quite as was promised to her when she was recruited. Her boss has gone, the chief constable has been edged out in disgrace, the headquarters aren't working, and she partners up with a young graduate trainee, Harry, who is known as Westlife, nicknamed Westlife for his boy band Good Looks. And really, I think what she brings in her methodology is simply the knowledge of the area and her understanding of people.
So to summarize, she has moved back home looking to quiet down her life, and instead she finds herself with no team and a really grisly homicide where she is the lead investigator. So good luck, Nicola. I love, you mentioned her kind of boy band good-looking partner, who she keeps saying, look, don't worry about the motive yet. Don't try to figure out the why. Just figure out the facts. What happened? When? Where? How? And then we'll figure out the why. It reminded me a little bit of being a reporter, my job.
Oh, that's interesting. There's a lot of similarities, isn't there, in terms of that putting the story together, putting the case together, and finding the narrative and not jumping to conclusions until you have the facts. So that's really interesting you kind of identify that.
Mm. Okay, so the pub, the White Hart of the title, I mentioned this is one of two pubs in town. There is tension between them. Hovering over your whole story is this question of whether this town is big enough for both of them. Would you describe these pubs and how they function as the heart of this whole community?
Yeah, the White Hart is a drinker's pub, a bit more spit and sawdust and wooden tables, and is a little bit run down. And the other pub in town is the Fox, and that has become a gastro pub and much more known for its food offer, a little bit more modern. And what I wanted to do with that rivalry between the pubs is there's a bit of a crisis of the pub industry in Britain right now. Pubs are closing at a really swift rate, and that sense of the pub as a metaphor for the country and sort of the defining image of British life was something I really wanted to look into. What are pubs for? Why do we want them? What is the thing about gathering in a bar or a pub, and what do we expect from it, and how have they changed over the years?
So in a way, your novel begins and ends with a death at the White Hart. At the start of the novel, it is Jim Tiernan, the pub's owner, who we spend the rest of the book trying to unravel how he ended up in this chair in the middle of the road with deer antlers on his head. At the end, it's the pub itself that is dying. It's closing its doors for good, which struck me as a lovely symmetry. And I also wondered if that was intentional. Were you trying to leave us, the reader, with something?
Yeah, I think it's the sense of change that is going through, I'm sure, not just the UK, but all around the world. And in terms of how these communities function, what is at the heart of the community, how we find our community these days. Is it in buildings? Is it in people? Is it in traditions? And that's what the novel is, hopefully, alongside the great twisty-turny mystery, is investigating.
And this is your home, right, Chris Chibnall? You've lived in Dorset, England for decades?
Yeah, I've been here 20 years now, and I live a mile from the beach where we film Broadchurch. I'm in the middle of the community that I'm writing about in Death at the White Hart. So this area and these people and all of our lives are of, you know, profound and fundamental interest to me.
And a lot of murders, as you would seem to tell it. So is there something about this countryside that inspires grim stories, or do you think wherever you lived you would manage to come up with something?
I mean, I think the lovely thing about the countryside or chocolate box village murder mystery is the dissonance between the two things. You know, you have the beautiful nature of the landscape and the idyllic nature of the village, and then contrasting with the heinous act of a murder. So they are very, very rare. But I think the tension between those two acts is what becomes, you know, hopefully delightful to a reader, as well as interesting and provocative.
Chris Chibnall is author of the new novel, Death at the White Hart. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Young and healthy, and you've got charms. It would really be a sin not to have you in my arms. I'm young and healthy.